Good afternoon. We are broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia. It's time for the Doctors Roundtable, which is a forum for conversations with Atlanta's leading doctors and thought leaders about cutting-edge trends and topics in health, wellness, and lifestyle issues. I'm Tanya Mack. I'm your host for today. And joining me today is Dr. Aaron Goldberg, a local pediatrician in Dunwoody, Georgia. Dr. Goldberg graduated from the Medical College of Georgia. He's involved with the Academy of Pediatrics. He loves practicing, and he's married and has 4 grown children, 9 great-grandchildren.
That's right, that's right.
You're a busy guy already, I can tell.
For sure.
He's a member of Temple Emmanuel, a tennis player, a sports fan, and frequently speaks around the community about pediatric issues, and we appreciate you joining us today.
Well, thank you for asking.
I thought one of the ways that we could kind of get our topic today is respiratory illnesses in children, because it's that time of year where we see a lot of the flus, bronchitises, asthma triggers, that kind of thing. And I thought a way that we could approach it is maybe having you talk a little bit about the anatomy of the respiratory system is divided into upper and lower, and then we'll talk about upper illnesses and then lower illnesses, if that's okay with you.
That's great.
Okay, so why don't we start with a little bit, just kind of dividing for us the structures of upper and lower.
Well, respiratory illnesses often start as upper respiratory type infections, and then soon you'll have symptoms of lower respiratory disease. Upper respiratory we consider above the neck, sort of like the sinuses and the nasal passages. Even through the eyes, a lot of this drainage that children will have through the eyes is actually coming from their sinuses and a sign of a sinus infection. Of course, in the throat, strep throat is prevalent this time of year. You can get infection even in the neck through the trachea, which is the windpipe, and that's sort of a middle ground between the lower respiratory, which you think of the lungs, the chest. It's the trachea, and there's something called croup, where a child gets very barky, and it can be very, very serious. To me, the most serious illness in a small child, potential danger. You can get laryngitis in that area. And then the lower airway is where you get your wheezing, you get your coughing, you get pneumonias. And there's certain viruses that tend to attack more lower, some that mostly just stay in the head. You never get the lower respiratory symptoms. And there's certain viruses that cause the croup and that very scary barking sound that parents are afraid to hear. And to tell you the truth, as a pediatrician, when I'm on the phone with one of these mothers and I hear the barking in the background, my heart sort of speeds up also.
Okay, great. Really appreciate that. So I think it's pretty common. Isn't this time of year, is it the most common for respiratory
viruses? Right.
The
respiratory viruses seem to flourish in the colder weather. And so that's why you see quite an upsurge. We're starting to see more flu this year than last year. We're actually having a regional sort of flu in Georgia, but the rest of the Southeast is actually having a sort of epidemic-type flu, which is called widespread flu. And one thing, though, that helps all these illnesses, because they tend to flourish in schools, is the holiday break. The holiday break will actually simmer down a lot of these respiratory illnesses. And sometimes the parents come in and say, I'm scared I'll get my child sick. No, it's most likely your child will get you sick. It's mostly flourishes at schools, daycares, and places like that.
And better than it might move home. So it's important for the parents to realize kind of what's going on.
Oh, sure, sure. Right. New parents will be sick for sure.
I read some statistics somewhere that said something like a child under 5 may get as many as 3 to 8 colds, flus, respiratory symptoms per year. Is that sound right?
I think having the respiratory illness is fairly frequent. What we're more worried is how a child handles it. Some children just have a upper respiratory infection, maybe a slight lower respiratory infection, few days, and they're over it. The complications of these viruses is what worries us, and some children seem to have a tendency not to be able to handle these viruses, and they lead to other infections like ear infections. They lead to pneumonias, and sometimes just the viruses themselves lead to wheezing, bronchospasm, asthma-like presentation. So you have your asthma, which is with a child all the time, whether they're crying or they're running or they're laughing and they'll start coughing and wheezing. Or what is more common is when they get these respiratory illnesses, then they'll have the wheezing and the coughing and the asthmatic response, which is sort of like bronchospasm or reactive airway disease. And so kids that have this, kids that tend to get ear infections, kids that tend to get pneumonias with their viruses, these are the real worrisome children. And sometimes knowing the history and being on top of that, bringing them back for a revisit to decide, in those cases, they may need antibiotics are very important for pediatricians.
Very good. Well, let's just jump in. We're going to talk about upper respiratory illnesses first, which I have kind of on my list. I want to cover flu. We'll start there. Flu, croup, RSV, and sinusitis. So you mentioned we're having kind of a bad flu season here in Atlanta.
Right.
Why don't we start talking a little bit about that and the flu?
Well, the biggest change that's been a help for us is that the American Academy now recommends all children up to 18 years of age get their flu vaccine. It used to be that we only gave it to high risk. Then we only gave it to the younger children. And now it's recommended for everybody. And that is obviously the best way to avoid the flu. We have a few recalcitrant moms, but I want to say to everybody out there, they have refined the flu vaccine. A lot of these reactions from the past, we no longer have. And knock on wood, I very, very seldom ever have any of the children in my office have reactions to the flu vaccine. Now, one thing that's a little controversial when somebody gets the flu is the treatment with Tamiflu. Years ago, we had other medications, Simitrel, Flumidine, that we treated the flu with, and we tended to start right when they had the flu, and we treated them. The American Academy came out that you needed to treat the flu within 2 days, 48 hours or so, of starting with the fever and the flu symptoms in order for the Tamiflu, which is the new drug that we treat with, to be effective. So I've always sort of waited. I always thought, how long has this child been sick? And then I would make my decision for the Tamiflu. They have come out recently in the last couple of years also that if it's not a high-risk patient and the child doesn't seem to be overly sick with it, where it's other manifestations like vomiting, wheezing, asthmatic-like response, then to hold off and just do symptomatic treatment and hold off on the Tamiflu. So, you know, now we have to take more things into consideration. I evaluate how sick the child is, and we decide on treatment with the Tamiflu. Of course, beside the flu vaccine, the best thing to avoid is making sure anybody coughs into the crock of their elbow, inside their elbow, so that the virus is not on their hands, and that's how it spreads. And one thing that's helped, obviously, is this period when holiday, when school's out, and less exposure, but a lot of families are getting together, and when families are getting together for the holidays, just have to be careful with the hand washing and trying to have the person who's coughing or may have the flu to watch where they cough. So these are some of the things about the flu. I don't know if you had some more particular questions.
Well, one question about it. I had just as a parent is, I know I've been a parent, and my kids sometimes they feel bad. They have a little fever. I think they're going to be okay. They're just going to ride it out at home. But I also know they can get into trouble. So what would be a good guideline as to whether a parent should actually bring them in? If we're past the 48 hours for the Tamiflu treatment, what kind of things should we look out for that would say, no, you really need to visit the pediatrician?
Well, generally the complications in the smaller children are ear infections. So if you have a child, usually the flu makes you kind of tired and lethargic and you want to sleep more. If you have a younger child, say under three, or that doesn't want to sleep, that can't get to sleep, wakes up, you might be suspicious of an ear infection in that group. Another thing to worry about is if the fever goes away after 2 or 3 days and then all of a sudden a day or two later it comes back, you could be getting a pretty severe secondary infection like pneumonia. I guess it still could be an ear infection, and so maybe bronchitis. So it would be very important to go in and see a doctor then. I don't like vomiting. I feel that anybody with a significant fever that's vomiting has to always be checked out. It could be something very serious. Could even within a couple days of where the child has the flu, if they're really vomiting, a sign of pneumonia or pretty significant underlying disease. One thing I've always taught my new associates is never assume anybody with a fever and vomiting has something like the flu or stomach virus. There are a lot of serious things that you need to get it checked out.
Yeah, very good. Well, I'd like to move on a little bit to RSV, which stands for respiratory syncytial. You say it
syncytial.
For me. Syncytial virus. I was reading some facts from the CDC that said this is one of the most common things in kids under two. And almost all children might be infected by their second birthday. So it's a question of how serious it gets and if it advances. But why don't you tell us a little bit about
RSV?
Well,
there's a couple things significant about RSV. They've worked forever on a vaccine for RSV, have not been able to come up with an effective vaccine. The second thing about RSV is that you get it at the beginning of the winter, you can get it again at the end of the winter. You don't develop immunity even to the actual disease, the virus itself. And so you can get it every season. You can get it twice in a season. And it has significant symptoms in the younger children, particularly prematures. And what it does, it causes a lot of fluid to develop in the lungs, and the child has a very hard time moving the fluid, getting it out. It causes the child to wheeze and often will have trouble breathing. We often bring these children back. It's a 2-week illness. The first week they get gradually worse. The second week they get gradually better. And in that first week, at any point, particularly for a premature baby, a small baby, a baby under years, it could even very quickly develop difficulty breathing, lack of oxygen. And so we often tell these moms, if anything happens, get right to us or to the emergency room. These babies are sent home on nebulizers to give them breathing treatments at home in order to try to prevent the wheezing and the difficulty breathing, the bronchospasm. And, you know, it's a controversy on the fluid that builds in the lung. I've been practicing for 37 years.
Don't date yourself.
I know. But I've always had used steroids in these like we do in asthma patients. And the American Academy has come out in the last few years that the steroids weren't effective and shouldn't be used. So, I use them judiciously, but occasionally, even because I've done it so much and before I've done it, thinking that maybe some of this fluid can be controlled. But a lot of these babies, particularly under 6 months and premature, end up with oxygen in one of the children's mm-hmm. hospitals.
And then for some of our listeners who aren't medical, the viral you don't treat with
antibiotics
for viruses.
RSV is never treated with antibiotics. Sometimes, maybe in the younger child we're talking about under a year, 18 months, maybe 25, 30% will develop an ear infection, but we're we're always bringing them back to check their lungs, and we always look in their ears. So we will usually pick those up pretty quickly and get them started on antibiotics.
Okay, and one of my personal favorite upper respiratories that I've suffered with, and I know my kids, sinusitis, which seems right. very hard to clear up to me. So can you speak a little bit to...
Well, what often starts as a clear, runny nose and just low-grade fever over many days, which is just a virus, the rhinovirus, adenovirus, different viruses that can just cause these upper respiratory symptoms. Gradually, the mucus may darken. It may get real thick. The child, if they're old enough, will say or feel real pressure in the front of their face over their sinuses. Now, the sinuses above the eyes don't develop to after 8 or 9, so that's not where the pain would be in a younger child. It would be
under their eyes.
It'd be under their eyes, mm-hmm. and they'll get like maybe circles under their eyes. And often a sign, as I mentioned earlier, is the pus and infection in the sinuses will push out through the eyes along with coming out through the nose. And sometimes it just drains down the back of the throat. Now, the ones that comes through the nose and through the eyes, and we don't often treat with antibiotic maybe at the first day or two when it turns real dark, but over several days, if it has turned very dark and it's coming out, the fever's still around, the child's got pressure on their face, we need to get that child right on an antibiotic. One of the problems, and that's why we don't want to give antibiotics too frequently, is resistance.
Well, I was going to bring that up today.
Resistance.
So that's a big controversial thing
now,
use of antibiotics.
With sinus and ear infections. And that's why we use, the best antibiotic that usually works, but sometimes it doesn't because it's a resistant, generally it's a pneumococcus in these sinus ear infections. So when we've tried one or two, we often have to go to a drug that's tailored for these resistant bugs. But that's the reason we should never start antibiotics too early. And as a sort of like a cook, I feel like as a doctor, you don't want salt's nice, but not too much salt. And, sugar's nice, but not too much sugar. It's the same sort of thing with the antibiotics. You don't want to start them too early, but you don't want to wait till the child is so sick that maybe you'll end up in the hospital. So you try to find just the right point to start them. And I think that's what all the pediatricians, try
now,
to
I know
do.
You see children up to 18, right?
That's right,
is
yes.
kind of your cutoff
mm-hmm.
point. I know smaller ones probably can't handle it, but, of course, like lay people, we're watching TV and we see Dr. Oz with these neti pots and sinus flushing. What's your opinion on
they definitely work well. The problem is the child doing
compliance.
Compliance.
The problem is compliance.
Even you'd be surprised how adolescents sometimes aren't as cooperative. their rebellion is for things like that.
I don't know, though. It seems like little kids are always sticking things up their nose. So
well,
I think you never know.
Let me tell you this. For allergies, we often give nose sprays, and I would say that half of the adolescents, close to half, maybe a third, let's say, refuse to
use. Can't handle that even.
They don't even handle the spray, and so I think the washes are great, the saline washes.
Okay.
It's just getting the cooperation. So yeah. Hopefully, maybe half might cooperate, but we often in the older child that we think we have a chance, we'll do it. But I'm glad you brought it okay. up because it's definitely one of the treatments.
Well, it's an easy home prevention thing if you can tolerate it, I think. Let's move on. You mentioned whooping cough and how scary that sounds as we
right.
kind of head down toward our throat as far as pediatric illnesses and respiratory tract. So tell us a little bit about how that comes about, and I think. For some reason, it seems like these things always appear at night, like when the kids kind of settle down for the night and then they kind of get horizontal and then all this comes up and they start coughing. And I know it's very frightening for parents to start hearing that kind of barking sound.
Well, you're sort of confusing croup and whooping cough.
Okay.
So I'm going to talk about both.
Great.
But let's start with the whooping cough since you
okay.
mentioned that. The great news with the whooping cough as opposed to RSV is the whooping cough, there is a vaccine. And we started the children off at 2 months of age, and 4 months of age, they get a second one. And we consider them pretty resistant when they get the second one. The bad news with the vaccines, it seems to wane pretty quickly. Within 4 or 5 years, you're susceptible to the whooping cough. We now give the whooping cough vaccine 2, 4, 6 months. I give it in my office at 15 months, and then at 4 years. The next one's not till 11. They're now finding in a lot of areas where there seems to be an epidemic of whooping cough that the 9 and 10-year-olds are coming down with whooping cough, and of course they've lost their resistance, their immunity with the vaccine. Whooping cough is very severe, and what it is the child is normal for 3, 4, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and then it has spasms of coughing. It'll cough, 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 cough. We're talking about minutes. Cough, cough, cough. It chokes, it vomits, it turns red, blue, and if you catch them between those episodes, you're not even sure the kid's sick. They almost look completely normal. And the mom comes in and says, oh, my gosh, you can't believe how this child
But when they go
coughing.
To the pediatrician, they're fine. So well, as a parent, you think that
you know, but if you get the history of that spasm was causing the child to vomit, it's lasting a while, and you get a history of the mother has refused vaccines. That's one thing we deal with. That moms sometimes want to either wait on vaccines or don't want them at all. Well, you know that child's at high risk. If you're under 4 months of age, that child's high risk. I know the obstetricians, and we're trying to do as pediatricians, when a new baby's born, all the caretakers of that baby are to get the whooping cough vaccine to protect the baby.
Infant,
so
yeah.
We do that. So if you catch the whooping cough with these spasms of coughing in the first week, there is treatment for it, which is good. Otherwise, there's not much you can do, and often these spells are so severe that the child ends up in the hospital just to be observed and maybe give some oxygen and try to keep fluids in, because they often keep vomiting because these are such violent coughing.
Is there something you give for spasm control, like a?
Well, you know, I guess if they're older, you know, you have like the Mucinex type, okay. Children's Mucinex, something that will thin mm-hmm. the mucus out. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing you can really do because I guess it's just such a thick mm-hmm. sort of mucus, mm-hmm. and once it starts, whatever it does to the system of coughing, it just seems to make it spasm. And it's really, when you see one of these, it is scary for that episode. But to talk about croup, which is caused mainly by the parainfluenza virus, there's no vaccine against it. And it can be caused, croup, generally, if it's caused by a virus, there's fever, and it does last a few days. And it can be sort of scary. And it's the one that presents with the barking, really like a seal sometime when it's really bad. And it's really, really scary when you hear it. It sounds like a seal. And after they finish the coughing with the seal bark, they'll often have stridor where they go.
Right. Trying to get air.
Mm-hmm. Trying to get. And of course, it's narrow in the windpipe, in the trachea. And it's very scary in the smaller ones because their trachea is often the size of a pencil. And if that thing is swelling and mucus is closing it off, it's life-threatening very, very quickly. Now, there are things that can give relief. It seems like humidity helps. Often this is in the winter when the house is very closed in. The heat dries you out. So one of the treatments is just getting outside in the cool night air. There's more humidity out there, and sometimes it helps. Steaming the bathroom, you know, just sitting in there with toys, playing with the child while the water is steaming the bathroom, the hot water steaming the bathroom, that will often help. I remember hearing some pretty bad croup on the phone, telling parents, you could hear the bark on the phone, and some Strider, and I would tell him, go straight to the hospital, and I'd see him later in the office, and I said, well, what happened when you got to the emergency room? He said, well, when I got outside, put him in the car, started driving, by the time I got halfway to the hospital, he was doing fine. So now, you know, if that happens, what I say is, you know, do the same thing, you know, maybe try taking him outside, but normally I just say, take him in the car, roll the windows down, go to the emergency room, and if you get halfway there and the child sounds fine, then just getting outside.
Save your money.
That's right. That's right. That way, it's at least it's safer in case it doesn't, one of those cases where it doesn't work.
What about sleeping with a humidifier?
Well,
is that helpful or not?
The humidifier with Croup is definitely helpful. Anything from the neck up, the humidifier helps.
Okay.
It helps Croup. It helps sinus. It helps upper respiratory type infection. The one thing to worry about with the humidifier, of course, is it asthma. It doesn't get down to help with lower respiratory in the chest type illness. And a lot of asthmatics are allergic to mold, so it's very important that you clean out the humidifier. Otherwise, mold will grow in the humidifier.
It actually will trigger then the asthma, right? So kind of counter.
That's right, it will.
Well, let's move on into the lower respiratory tract. There's the big three, I think, bronchitis, pneumonia, and asthma. So why don't we start with asthma, that kind of cold itself sometimes is a trigger for asthma, kind of the opposite of what we were talking about.
Right, right. Well, there's three types of asthma, and of course they can, you know, cross over. They can you can have two or all three of the kinds of three of the causes of asthma. One is allergies, which everybody knows, you know, from the mold to the dust to the cat, the dog, maybe pollen season, you know, people's asthma will flare up. The second are irritants, which people don't think about. You'd be surprised in my office how many asthmatics, when I mention scented candles, air freshener, bleach, perfume, paint, all these fumes.
Irritants,
and they directly trigger asthma by irritating. Smoke, of course, smokers. Now, things have changed since I started practicing 37 years ago. There were a lot of smokers then, so I had to get on the soapbox. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, fortunately, very few of my parents smoke. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy about that. Mm-hmm. But irritants is the second. And then the third are these viruses trigger the asthma. Now, when the viruses trigger the asthma, that's generally the asthma that's outgrown.
Okay.
And the reason so many small children have asthma is more is predominant in the young child is because they catch all these viruses. They don't have the immunity to fight them off. And when they get the viruses that get lower respiratory area, causes different mucus in their chest. It can trigger the wheezing and the trouble breathing and things like that.
Okay, now I heard asthma is very, you mentioned it's predominant. I saw some statistics, something like 6% of kids under 5 have it. It's very, very common.
One
in 18.
It's very common. But a significant amount of those are ones that will outgrow it, and those are the ones that get the that are triggered by infections. The same viruses we're talking about are much more common in the children, and most adults have better immunity to it. But, you know, new parents who haven't been around anybody sick for years and years, then they'll develop their immunity by getting sick around their children. But with age, you just tend to get better immunity.
Okay. Very good. Now, is it a fair statement to say that the lower respiratory diseases could be more severe with, like, the drainage and the
Well, asthma can be very severe where you have to give multiple treatments with the nebulizer. You have to give shots of steroid. They'll need oxygen, which they have to be hospitalized if the treatments and the shot of, say, steroid doesn't help. And any of those three, and you know, if the trouble is pollen and allergy, you're going to see your asthmatics have more trouble in the spring, maybe in the fall.
More seasonal.
But since most of the kids get it from viral illnesses, we see more in the winter. And if it's just irritants, That's year round. Right, that could be any time.
Well, let's talk a little bit about bronchitis.
Right. And bronchitis is either viral or bacterial infection of the bronchial tubes. Mm-hmm. So with these viruses, you get just a normal mucus sound in the chest, and we say the child may have some bronchitis. A good many of those are viral. We don't need an antibiotic. Sometimes they just sound a little worse. They sound like, well, maybe there could be a little pneumonia in there too. And so we may want to treat those with antibiotics. A lot depends on, you know, if they're spiking high fevers, particularly if the fever was low and it all of a sudden went up high, we'd be suspicious of a bacterial bronchitis. If the child's old enough and we call sputum, which is what they spit out, if it's thicker and greener and yet more yellow, we might be more suspicious, obviously, of a bacterial that needs antibiotic. And, of course, pneumonia is like a crackling in the lungs when you listen and you hear crackles. But a lot of times the pneumonia is like a big plug, and you don't hear crackles, but you just see a sick child. You're just suspicious of what is going on, high fevers, has some cough, but maybe not so bad because sometimes that thing is so thick you can't really cough any of it up, and you get an X-ray, and you see a big chunk of pneumonia in there, and that's a seriously ill child, needs at least shots of antibiotic. Occasionally, you know, we need to be admitted because the child's so sick.
So is X-ray diagnostic to diagnose pneumonia?
I think clinically you can for some, but when they have the more severe pneumonia with the big plug, often you don't hear it. You just suspect it because of the way the child is looking and the fever and the course of the illness. And a lot of times they almost are trying to cough, but because that stuff's so thick, it's like nothing's moving.
And then you mentioned if they have a high fever. So what do you define as a high? What would be considered a high fever?
I think 103 or more, I would consider.
That is high. That's very mm-hmm. high. Okay, well, we've gone through most of the big respiratory illnesses. I know if we said we had an extra minute, we would just ask, is there anything that you want to communicate to our listeners that you feel might be helpful tips for them in general that may be non-respiratory?
Well, there are two diagnoses that seem to manifest, that are very common, that seem to manifest and different symptoms that most parents out there don't realize. Sometimes when I tell them what I think the diagnosis is, they look at me in disbelief. One is constipation. If you think about constipation, we're talking about big, heavy stool all through the abdomen. Nowadays, children, you know, we don't start off with much juice in babies. We used to give a lot of juice, didn't have as much. We had more diarrhea. Now, without the juice, and I think with all the snack foods and all, we have a really lot of constipation. But those big, heavy stools can push against the bladder. They can push against the stomach. So reflux is often a sign, when the child didn't have it when they were younger, it's often a sign of constipation. The stool pushing on the stomach, causing acid reflux, heartburn, things like that. Also, urinary symptoms. The stool pushing on the bladder, where they have frequency, they have even urinary tract infections because they can't empty the bladder because of the stool, and they even might complain of burning just because of the way the stool pushes it out so hard. That we can see that too. And I have also seen, I know you're not going to believe this one, I have seen diarrhea as a manifestation of constipation. I remember vividly a patient my PA had worked up for diarrhea with all the different studies, came back and I said, well, did you get an X-ray to see if the child's constipated? It could be leaking around these huge stools. It's not uncommon that children severely constipated leak around the stools. They can't control it because their rectum is so distended that it just leaks around. Their colon is distended. And lo and behold, we got an X-ray, and it was full of stool. We treated the constipation, and the diarrhea went away. So that shows you. There's a lot of different manifestations to that. The other thing is hypoglycemia, low blood sugar. A lot of people know when the sugar's low that you feel lethargic, listless. You might get a headache. You might even pass out. That's one of the main causes at school, what we call syncope, which is passing out. Child eating Fruit Loops goes to school. The sugar goes high with the Fruit Loops. In 30 or 40 minutes, it goes low. And then they can't get any more sugar, so they get lightheaded and pass out. But the way you raise your sugar, one of the ways, growth hormone is one, but the other is your adrenaline shoots out. And in some people, their adrenaline shoots out great, and it raises their sugar. So when they're really hypoglycemic, they never really realize it because the adrenaline shoots out, but you get the effect of your adrenaline. So I've had children come in with fast heart rates, skipped heartbeat, things that are cardiac due to the adrenaline, that didn't realize that their whole problem was low blood sugar. And you know, of course, we get EKGs, make sure there's not a real cardiac problem. But when everything seems to check out fine, even if I have to send them to the cardiologist and it checks out fine, and I get a history of sugary cereals, lots of sugar through the day, and we realize the problem. And so I just thought I would bring those two up to kind of help parents realize that.
So before we close, being that we started on respiratory illnesses, what's just your very brief one or two tips for parents for this flu season, cough, croup, whatever season?
Well, first, I would urge you to get the flu vaccine. Within a couple weeks, it's effective. All the bad press in the past, the word of mouth in the past about reactions to the flu vaccine, it has been refined. There is minimal to no reaction in all the pediatricians' offices, and every one of us gets it. Every one of my children and grandchildren gets it. So it's very important that you get the flu vaccine.
And how long will this be going on that we can get the vaccine? Not be too late.
We would recommend it to the beginning of March because the flu will occur through March.
Okay, very good. And you've certainly been an expert for us today. We really appreciate you coming. All the parents and internists and people that would like to refer to you, how can they find you?
Well, there's a website that we have that you might want to let them know.
It is www.pediatrichealthcenter.com, if I may. And your phone number is 678-336-5255.
And sometime if you just want to come and talk, there's never a charge for anybody that just wants to see the office. And I don't mind if you even have one problem that your child has and you want to come by and talk to me. As you probably notice, I like to talk, and I'm happy to approach any subject that you're interested in. And hopefully I can be helpful to you.
Well, thank you so much for coming today.
You're welcome. Thank you for asking me to come.
The Doctor's Roundtable has been a production brought to you by HealthGate and Business Radio X. HealthGate is a groundbreaking website where board-certified doctors and specialists offer savings on out-of-pocket healthcare costs. For more information about HealthGate, please visit www.healthgate.com, or you can call 404-692-5377. We hope you tune in next week, and thank you for listening.